It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
And this week, we're off to Soviet Russia in the midst of the space race. Plucked from the streets of Moscow, Laika became the first dog sent into space aboard Sputnik 2 on November the 3rd, 1957. The canine cargo was strapped into the rocket with not even enough space to turn around. But curiously, she did have a window. What would Laika have seen as she travelled so far away from home? It was this thought that set American writer Kurt Caswell on his mission to understand more about this fascinating chapter of space history and this pioneering dog's legacy. He wrote a book called Laika's Window. Good morning to you, Kurt, and welcome to Nightlife.
Good morning.
Look, I understand it is 6 a.m. in Texas, so thank you so much for getting up early for us this morning. Look,
absolutely.
What was it about that thought of Laika having a window that just got under your skin, Kurt?
Well, you know, we're so often used to giving ourselves credit, you know, human beings credit for so many of these amazing firsts in science and exploration. And I imagine that, you know, Laika was really the first living being to look back at the Earth from orbit. It was not Yuri Gagarin or, you know, a human being. So I thought we should give credit to Laika where, you know, her credit was warranted.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's dive into the history of this mission first. Take us back to 1957. Nikita Khrushchev is the leader of the Soviet Union, and the space race was heating up. How was that playing out at the time?
Well, as you know, as we were kind of tumbling into the Cold War, the space race was really a kind of proxy for the Cold War, and the United States and the Soviet Union are vying for technological superiority, and that meant certainly superiority in space exploration. So the United States was practicing with and testing the bounds of that of the atmosphere by sending monkeys up on rockets just to the edge of space. And the Soviet Union had been working with dogs. And really, it was a race to see who could get there first and who could get a human being, a man, into space.
Yeah, okay. So when were the states sending monkeys up? Was it around this same time?
Yeah, simultaneous with the Soviet missions with dogs, monkeys were going up. And, you know, often those monkeys were very fragile and they had a hard time, you know, trying to figure out how to bring them back alive, whereas the dogs in the Soviet Union were much hardier. And they brought many dogs back alive on parachutes. But they were not talking about, you know, sending animals into orbit so much as just to the edge of space and then back on a parachute.
Okay. Gosh, it's wild to think that those dogs came back alive. Some of them came back alive.
Yeah, many of them did. And, you know, they would go find the rocket as it came down, or the capsule, and the dogs would come bursting out of there. And they would, of course, take them to the veterinarian and ask what happened to that dog, you know, as it reached the edge of space.
Yeah.
Was it alive, and could human beings survive up there?
Yeah, wow. So when, as you mentioned, this is a bit of a race to get the first human up. did this mean that there were maybe designs or getting to this mission, some of it was rushed itself?
Yes, absolutely. There was a lot of rushing going on. And so after Sputnik 1 went up, the United States was certainly alarmed, and so was the rest of the world, that the Soviet Union had that capacity and could send a missile essentially into the upper atmosphere and, you know, bend it around the Earth and drop a bomb on the U.S. So once Sputnik 1 went up, the Soviet Union decided, hey, we can further embarrass the United States and terrify them by sending up another satellite very quickly. And about a month later, they sent up Sputnik 2. But it had to be something much more spectacular. So Sputnik 2 was much heavier, much larger. And of course, they thought, you know, the best thing here was to send one of their trained space dogs up, and that would become the first living being to go into orbit, which of course was Laika.
Okay. And what was the idea kind of around this? Because they knew it was going to be a one-way mission, didn't they?
Right. They knew it was going to be a one-way mission. Many of the previous launches, the dogs had that return plan because they were just going to the edge of space. But at the time, nobody knew how to deorbit a satellite, bring it back through the atmosphere, and then, you know, land it on the ground or splash down into the ocean or something like that. So the hurry of that mission, basically to establish that superiority, the Soviet Union thought, well, we will have to sacrifice this dog when we send it up.
Gosh. You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. With you is Kurt Caswell, the author of Laika's Window. And for this week in history, you're hearing all about Laika, the first dog to go up into space. Laika was on Sputnik 2. And you're hearing just about how this all came about. And, well, let's get into Laika herself. What kind of a dog was she? What did she look like?
Well, she was a small dog, about 13 pounds, short-haired, and her ears kind of bent over at the tips. She had some darker markings around her face, but generally she was white. And most of the space dogs were white in color, so that they showed up very well when they had that black and white camera on them in the capsule, because they wanted to watch those dogs to see, you know, how they were behaving and what was happening to them as they flew. So the white color of the dog helped them show up on camera.
Wow. Okay. And tell us about how she was found, because, well, they needed to find a tough dog, didn't they?
Right. And, you know, they did send teams out into the streets in Moscow. The training center and for the dogs was there in Moscow. And they would literally send a car around with a couple people in it, and they would just pick up dogs off the street. And so Laika came from, you know, that kind of tough Moscow street stock. And so she had likely survived at least one winter, you know, in Moscow. And they thought, well, these are good candidates for enduring this rigorous training that they had to undergo to fly in these rockets.
Gosh. Well, what was her temperament like? Do we know much about her temperament?
We know a little bit. There may be much more, you know, available in archives in Russia, if you speak Russian and read Russian. But it's well known that, you know, the team of veterinarians and caregivers, they really liked Laika a lot. And one of the things about her name means little barker, or a dog that barks. And so it's quite likely that she had a, you know, maybe even annoying habit of barking a lot.
Right. It's interesting that they went to find, you know, a tough street dog, but at the same time, they really needed to train this dog, didn't they?
Right. Yeah. She underwent a number of training trials. You know, they would put the space dogs on an agitation machine that shook them back and forth. So they simulated that sense of riding up in the rocket. They were trained over long periods of time in these small capsules to see how they endured those tight spaces. And you know, the dogs that really failed in these tests were cycled out of the training. So they didn't just, you know, cast these dogs up into space against their will completely. They were looking for dogs that managed the training quite well. And so Laika was one of those dogs, unfortunately, you know, for her.
Yeah. Yes. So it sounds like that there were quite a few rounds that other dogs were unsuccessful then, Kurt.
Exactly. And a lot of these dogs that they picked up off the street, whether they flew or not, they would rehome them often in the homes of various military personnel who wanted to pick one up, you know. So they were very well taken care of and well loved by, you know, the Russian team.
Wow. Your Nightlife on ABC Radio with you is Kurt Caswell, who's telling you all about the first dog to go up into space, Laika, went up in Sputnik 2. So talk us through what kind of preparation Laika went through, because, well, they had to train her to be, well, comfortable as possible in a very small space, didn't they?
Right, exactly. And she was really... you know, in the book, I call her the first cyborg, because she was really connected to the capsule that she flew in. You know, through there was a ECG machine, you know, so that they could take her pulse as she was flying. That information would be sent back down to the ground. So they had to do some surgery on her to connect her up to this capsule. They actually took her carotid artery out and sort of pulled it up onto the top of her skin and folded it into a flap of skin and sewed that up so that they could, you know, have a monitor on her pulse. And then she wore a vest that monitored her breathing, and she had to have a waste collection bag, you know, so that she was taken care of inside the capsule. And then there was a food water kind of mix that was given to her when she flew.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about how she was fed. I can't imagine it would be like a self-feeding machine like pets have these days, but what happened there?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The plans were to build a feeding machine, and the veterinarians had worked out this formula. They thought that the mission was intended to be 7 days, so that Laika would be in space and, you know, revolving around the Earth for 7 days. And so the idea was they would mix water and food together, and that it would stick to a kind of feeding tray, because otherwise, once she got into zero gravity, it would just float around in the capsule. So the feeding machine was never developed, because they decided to save on weight. And they ended up just putting a big portion of this kind of unappealing food into the capsule. It stuck to the feeding tray. But Laika was really sitting on the ground for almost 3 days before she launched. Once she was sealed into the capsule, They had some problems to work out. So she was in that capsule for nearly 3 days with just this, you know, food water mix. And it's quite likely, and I didn't see this, you know, written anywhere else, or documented anywhere else, but it's quite likely, if you just do the math on, you know, how much water does a dog need, how much of the size, how much water was in that food mix, that she was highly dehydrated even before they got off the ground.
Oh gosh, it's interesting, because it doesn't really sound like poor Laika was going through, well, the greatest conditions for living. But there were some, you've spoken to scientists and technicians involved, and they did form quite a bond with Laika and the other dogs, right?
Yes, absolutely. The dogs were well loved. In fact, when, like a flu, you know, there are many accounts of the scientists and engineers and the caregivers certainly just in tears as she flew because they knew that she was never coming back. So there was a great deal of empathy for the sacrifice that not only Laika, but the other space dogs were making.
Yeah. So what was the, if they knew that Laika wasn't going to return alive, what was the point again?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, the point was really to test the upper atmosphere and the ability for a living, breathing, you know, animal to exist in orbit. And the plan was to send a human being up and to do that before the United States did it. So, you know, they wanted to know, could Laika survive the rocket ride? Could she survive the insertion into orbit?
Gosh, okay. All right. Back to the technicians. You mentioned that some were crying when Laika went up into space. Did any have any kind of regret that they were sending poor Laika up to her death?
Yeah, they certainly did. The lead of the really the biological exploration team, they were pretty sad about this. Oleg Gazenko said, you know, afterwards that they didn't learn enough to justify Laika's death. And the chief medical officer, he actually, the story is that he actually took Laika home with him to play with his children the night before she was to travel out to the Baikonur Cosmodrome, which is in Kazakhstan, from Moscow. So she was brought into the home and, you know, he said that he wanted to give her something, to do something nice for her before her life ended.
Oh, gosh. And how did that go?
Well, it sounds like it went very well. The story is actually, you know, disputed by some people. I talked to Nikita Khrushchev's son, Sergei Khrushchev, who actually became a U.S. citizen. And, you know, he thought that that story was probably not genuine, that it would be impossible to get Laika out of that facility, that she was so, you know, valuable. But, you know, there are several accounts of it, and it persists in the story of Laika.
Okay, so take us to that fatal, that fateful day, November 3rd, 1957. How did it all go to plan?
Well, as you know from my earlier comments, the rocket sat on the ground for about 3 days with Laika sealed into the capsule, and just before launch, the veterinarian team and the caregivers grabbed Korolev, the chief designer, and said to him, "Hey, we need to change to repressurize the capsule that Laika's in. We need to open it up." And apparently, that permission was given. So just before launch, they opened up the capsule, but really the scheme was that the caregivers wanted to give her water. So they put water into the feeding tray because the food by this time was gone and they knew she was suffering. And so they gave her water just before launch. And then the rocket took off, further proving that, you know, Laika was probably very close to death by the time they launched. And then the capsule deployed from the rocket. It was in orbit, and Laika probably died about on the third revolution, third to fourth trip around the Earth. So she didn't last much more than 5 or 6 hours.
Oh, my gosh. That's quite sad, really.
Yeah.
What did the sensors pick up?
Well, they did pick up the fact that she survived, right? So they did get telemetry back from the capsule and they knew that Laika was alive and she was in orbit. And they thought, okay, well, this is some success because we now know that at least if we put a human being into orbit, they can at least come around the Earth one time and then return. So, you know, Laika made a trip around almost three or almost four times, and that was good information. But again, this key figure in that team, Oleg Gazenko, was saying that, you know, they didn't learn quite enough to justify her death, that they should have waited really to until they could deorbit the satellite and hopefully bring the dog back down.
Oh, gosh. Well, all right. Well, that's a really interesting point. Maybe we should get into that now. Did those thoughts, like, did it change the way that they then went about their space exploration missions?
Well, it really did. Once human beings started going into space, the dog program was ended, so that there were two more dogs that flew. Actually, a number of dogs flew after Laika, but two that were quite famous, Belka and Strelka, who went into orbit after they learned, you know, how to deorbit a satellite, and they flew for about 25 hours and then came back alive. And, you know, again, great heroes of the Soviet state at the time.
Mm. Okay, so it sounds like that they did learn from their lessons from sending Laika up then in many ways.
Exactly, yeah. I think the response that they didn't learn enough is really just the team empathizing with the dog and, you know, siding with her. But I don't think the Soviet state would have said the same thing. I think, you know, everybody who was watching this unfold was saying this proves that the Soviet Union is the superior nation.
Yeah. Okay. So what was the reaction on the ground? Because, you know, those working on the mission knew that Laika wouldn't come back, as we've discussed. But yeah, what do people on the ground make of that in Russia compared to the other countries? As you're kind of alluding to there, the Russians maybe they didn't really question it so much because they were going into space.
Correct. Yeah. You know, I'd say the public in the Soviet Union was probably fairly well in connection or concert with the government was saying, and they were saying that, you know, Laika was alive and well in space, and that the mission was a great success and, you know, glory to the Soviet Union. But in the West, especially in the United States and in Britain, the response was from many animal rights groups and from the public that this was a kind of cruel act. Even though the United States was sending up animals of their own and plenty of them were dying, that this was a cruel act and the Soviet Union, you know, should be condemned for it.
You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. I'm James Findlay, and with you is Kurt Caswell, who's the author of Laika's Window, the book that takes a look at Laika, first dog that went up into space in Sputnik 2. Unfortunately, knowing that poor Laika would not be coming back alive, you can join the conversation if you like. You can give me a call, 1-300-800-222, or the text line 0467-922-702. We'll get to some of your texts in a moment. What was it initially published about Laika's death, Kurt?
Well, the story was that, as I was saying, it was a great success that Laika, you know, lived for a number of days in space, and she brought all this data to the Soviet Union so that they could continue to do their research and get a human being into space. But the truth was quite different. When I talked to Sergei Khrushchev, you know, he insisted that because her death wasn't publicized, the team knew that Laika was gone after about 6 hours or so. But because the information wasn't publicized didn't mean they were trying to really cover it up. In the West, they felt, no, the Soviet Union, this is a big cover-up, you know. And the official story of how quickly Laika died didn't come out really until 2002.
When
you know, after the wall came down and the perestroika and all of that business was going on, there was a great deal of the literature from this period was translated into English, and a man named Dmitry Malashenkov was giving a talk at the World Space Conference in Houston in 2002, and he sort of admitted for the first time publicly that no, Laika really died, you know, between the third and fourth revolution, and, you know, they got very little data from her in space.
Wow. Okay. It is wild that the truth didn't come out until 2002.
Right. Right. And, you know, a lot of people in the West focus on that time gap there, but I think a lot of Soviets and certainly in this case, Sergei Khrushchev said, well, that's not really that important because the mission was a success. Laika did survive in space. A little bit like, you know, the multiple SpaceX trials with the Starship that keeps blowing up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
just part of the process, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But still, it was several decades, you know?
Yes. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Look, you reflect on the relationship between dogs and humans when you're looking into this story. What does Laika's story reveal about our relationship with animals, particularly dogs?
Well, one thing, you know, so the dog really evolved with human beings, and they can't survive without us. And I would argue in some ways we can't survive without us, without them. So the story, I think, reveals this mutual bond that we have with dogs, and that dogs often, you know, they act selflessly in protection and abeyance to their owners, and I would call this love. And so they're very courageous animals, and those animals that went up, the dogs that flew in the rockets, while they're not selecting, you know, they're not self-selecting to take on this danger and risk, they are bonded with the caregivers and would do anything for them. And I think that relationship is fairly unique. So the things that matter most to a dog, you know, are their person, perhaps food, and maybe, you know, some bad smells.
Yeah. Yeah. Plenty of that, I'd imagine. Look, how do you view the ethics of what happened to Laika, though, and animals in space?
Yeah, that's a real tough one because there's really nobody who's, you know, had medical attention that isn't benefiting from research with animals, but also in general just, I mean, the dogs that have gone into space, we've benefited from them too. Mm. So it's a hard nut to crack when you're saying, hey, I care about these animals. They shouldn't have been sent into space. But one of the keys, you know, in the research I was doing is that this was before international codes of ethics around animal research. And when you look at what the Soviets were doing with their dogs, they really exemplify those rules, which are in their most basic form, they are, you know, to refine the process and produce as little pain as possible for the animal, to reduce the frequency and number of animals used in research. And then also, if they can find another option, to replace them, not to use animals at all. And the Soviet Union was really, defining their research with these animals on those basic three principles. So I think they did as good a job as they could, but certainly there are animals that had to die.
Yeah. Hearing from you on the text line, 0467-922-702. One of you asks, is Sputnik 2 still in orbit or working? Kurt, it Sputnik 2 eventually did come back down to Earth, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, about in April of 1958. So the satellite, its orbit decayed and it burned up in the atmosphere. And it could be seen, actually, by plenty of people from the ground. And there are some reports of what that looked like. And, you know, Laika by that time would have been long gone. And she would have, you know, her body was probably in some kind of state of decay because the satellite had a highly elliptical orbit and it spent most of its time in the sun. So it would have heated up dramatically and then cooled down dramatically on the dark side of the Earth as it went around. So, you know, she was essentially returned to the Earth where she originated, only just her, you know, what became of her body was spread out through the atmosphere and rained back down on the planet.
Yeah, right. Did eventually come back to Earth, as you said, but, you know, as, well, remains. But she's still standing somewhere, though, isn't she?
Yeah.
In statue form.
Exactly. Yeah, and her memory, certainly. And she is an iconic hero of that early period of the space race, especially in the Soviet Union and some other neighboring countries. Maybe not so much in the United States. I found that people here, when I mentioned that, you know, I was working on a book about Laika, had never heard of her.
Oh, wow. Well, look, I'm sure many space lovers and dog lovers and animal lovers alike are pretty, very happy that you've been able to unmask some of the mystery there. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us on Nightlife and taking us through that through the history of Laika, the dog.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, you too. Kurt Caswell there, the author of Laika's Window here on Nightlife.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.